And welcome back to Coast. Tonight we will talk about some of the strange things that happened during 9/11. I know it's almost 14 years ago, but it's a subject that just cannot go away. Rebecca Roth joins us in a moment. Her work, Methodical Illusion, we'll be talking with her, and we'll explain who she is when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast. As I was mentioning when I was doing my chat a week or so ago with Coast Insiders, one of our listeners and insiders said, you got to have Rebecca Roth on. So we looked into it and went, yeah, we should. Rebecca, establishing herself as a foremost expert on 9/11, her new book is called Methodical Illusion. That combines about 30 years of her career as an international flight attendant, a purser. Rebecca has been able to bring into light theories of what really occurred on that fateful day. Rebecca Roth on Coast to Coast. Hey, welcome to the program, Rebecca.
Well, thank you so much, George. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I'm glad one of our listeners recommended you.
Yes, I am too.
So tell me a little bit more about yourself other than what we just had.
Well, you know, I had, like I said, I'd flown around 30 years. At the time of 9/11, I stopped flying in 2004. And, you know, I really didn't pay much attention to 9/11, what happened. It really changed the career so much. So those last 3 years were not easy for us. Part of the thing that happened immediately after 9/11 is the crew members were absolutely terrorized by the TSA. And I guess they did it so that the passengers could say, oh, if they're doing this to the crew members, we must be safe. And they would just squeeze out our toothpaste and, you know, rifle through our stuff. And at one point early on, when they formed this TSA, they have tables out in front in the gate area. You may remember this. And the flight crews, as we'd get to work, and we work on the plane, so we're going to work, and they would just open up our suitcases and rifle through all of our personal, our pajamas and our lotions. And they would do that right there in front of the passengers. It was just horrendous.
Well, I remember we would go through screening like that, and then at the gate, they would selectively pick out some people and do the same thing all over again.
Yes, they would do us and some selected passengers. And it was just really awful what happened. And so, you know, when I got away from flying, and during the time that I watched it happen, I had just missed it. I could have been on one of those jets that went sideways there on 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
I missed it by about 8 to 10 hours. I commuted from coast to coast. So it's kind of coast to coast has always been sort of my middle name.
That's right. Good.
And I just could have been there. So I was home, luckily, and I watched it unfold. And when I did, I saw things that weren't right. But when you're doing this for a living, it's impossible to look at it in depth. We always knew that jets would scramble within 6 minutes if we needed them. And on that day, we saw NORAD didn't scramble jets for over an hour and a half.
I know, that was bizarre. We'll get into that, too.
Yeah, and that was, you know, for us walking down the aisle and talking to you as a passenger, I knew that the government, that our military was going to be there should we need them. And after 9/11, I couldn't look at people the same way. I didn't have that feeling anymore. So it really changed our career. And I never really looked back at this at all until around 2008 or 9, I was going to write a novel. And everyone told me, you know, oh, you have such an exciting life, because I did. I always had lots of fun on my layovers and even on my downtime at home. And they said, oh, you should have so many things exciting happen. You should write a book. And so after I retired, I went to write a book. And when I started it, I wanted to grab a Middle Eastern name for a gentleman character that I was going to create. And I thought, well, I'll just go on Google and find one of those 19 Arab hijackers and take a first name off one and a last name off the other. When I hit that Google search, a BBC article popped up dated September 23, 2001, right after 9/11, and it told that the Saudi government was threatening to sue the FBI and the U.S. government for claiming that six of its citizens were the alleged hijackers, and they, in fact, were still alive.
That was a bizarre story. I remember that.
Yeah, that got my attention. I was like, what? Because I really hadn't looked closely at it, although I knew from the day one cell phones didn't work and protocols weren't being followed. And at that moment, I guess it was my time. God said, it's time to wake up, lady. And I put that novel aside, and I started doing thousands of hours of research. I'm kind of like that guy in Close Encounters, but I didn't build the Devil's Tower in my house. But I did build lots of charts.
How important was your flight experience for the research that you did for this book?
I used all of my years of training. And, you know, we do yearly training with the, was at the time the FAA. I don't know who does it now. But we had specific protocols in hijackings and any evacuation or any emergency commands that we all knew. If I would have got on a different airline than what I worked for and there was some kind of event, I knew what commands they would use, and I could have just jumped right in and helped them evacuate the aircraft. And I knew their commands because it was pretty universal what we were taught to do. And that was one of the things that caught my eye. And then when I started digging deeper into the phone calls, that is really the training is what I kept going back to, is why did this happen like that? Why would they say these things? And we'll talk about some of those things later on. And the details of the calls, especially that the flight attendants did, because the FAA protocols in our training weren't followed by any of the flight attendants or any of the pilots on board.
Well, the whole thing was strange. You know, I've got my own theories and thoughts about that, and I'll interject with you tonight, Rebecca, as we talk about this. When you were a flight attendant, did you enjoy that job?
Oh, it was great. After I was a flight attendant for several years, I became an international purser. And, you know, the international pursers, we had additional training, and we were the ones that if there was any trouble on board, any problems at all, whether it was a drunk or or high.
And you get all that.
I was, specially trained to handle those people.
How about the whack job that just charged the cockpit and he got tackled by the people who were on the plane?
Yeah, well, that's probably what would have happened if the scenario we were led to believe really did happen on 9/11. That's probably what would have happened. And I dug into some of these passengers, and you'll find them the most interesting, who just decided they'd sit on the phone and talk to their wife or someone instead of helping, because the hijackers were all very small people.
Well, my producer, Tom, who called you to get you on the line here, mm-hmm. he and I fly about 40 to 50 flights a year, and we have our own system in place if somebody would charge the cockpit,
mm-hmm.
because generally we get on pretty soon, pretty for, you know, we don't go first class. I fly Southwest a lot. Mm-hmm. But we get on, we've got an A number, and we're on pretty close. So we generally get the seats we want, and generally they're pretty close to the cockpit. And we've got our own little plan in place mm-hmm. that if we saw anybody, you know, I've even seen people accidentally try to open up the cockpit door thinking it was the bathroom,
mm-hmm.
which
that
is right,
happens a lot.
Yeah, which is right to the left. And, you know, and sometimes there aren't any flight attendants up there. They're in the back or doing whatever they're doing, But he and I are ready. We're ready to charge them if there looks like anything strange. And I was impressed with the people on this United flight that tackled this guy and held him down and did what they had to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's, you know, every once in a while there's just someone that, you know, has the screw loose. They're really crazy, and they do something crazy.
Yeah.
Remember the guy on that United plane that went pooey on the meal cart?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. That was really crazy. That was an international flight a couple year or two ago.
They just had a flight, too, where they had to turn around because the bathroom smelled too bad.
Oh, yes, I saw that.
Oh, my God.
Well, that happens sometimes, and what probably they didn't say, because a lot of the news we got from that was a British Airways flight. A lot of the news we got was from tweets and people on Twitter, and they were, you know, not part of it. I'm pretty sure what happens sometimes is the when they service the lavatories, they overfill with the fluid, and it'll come up over the toilets. And the toilets, of course, are right by the galleys where the food is kept. And so sometimes it'll flood, and there's just no way you can clean that up. We don't have the mops and the right equipment. And
did,
that, I think, was what was really happening.
Did you ever have a white-knuckle flight, Rebecca?
You know, I did. Over the years, I had some really crazy stuff. But when I very, very first started flying, I'm going to age myself here, I started on a 707. and very much very similar aircraft to the
76. Well, you're not aging yourself. It's better than saying that you were with the Orville and Wilbur Wright.
Yeah, well, I'm not that old.
You were in the back of their little plane, right?
Yeah. Sometimes I felt like that after those long Tokyo trips. But, yeah, I actually was on a 707. I was going into some place in Montana, some small little town, and these two old ladies called me over and said, "Is that normal?" And we have four engines on this wing, and one of them had 2-foot flames coming out. I hadn't been flying for a week.
Whoa.
And I looked out that window, and I saw that fire, and I said, "Oh, yeah, that happens all the time. Let me make sure the captain knows it's happening right now." When I got into first class, you could hear all the sirens going off, the fire alarms going off in the cockpit, and I woke, just opened the door, and I said, "Obviously, you know we're on fire."
So what's he do? Does he just shut it down right away?
Yeah, there are fire extinguishers that actually go off inside the jets. And so they were actually going off. So the fire went out quickly. But, yes, we did an emergency landing into, you know, I think it was in Montana, Billings or someplace. And we literally watched a volunteer fire department run to the fire station and then drive up the hill to the airport.
Rebecca, we're going to get into your work in a big way in just a second. But I want to tell you that we just got done publishing a book with the actor Richard Belzer and David Wayne called Someone is Hiding Something about the missing Malaysian plane. And let me tell you, this, you know, that's a year old now. These things just don't disappear. They leave some trail. And this is a weird story, isn't it?
It is very much so. And let me just quickly tell you what I saw when I saw that, because it's very much like what I discovered on the aircraft with 9/11. The aircraft on 9/11 were taken over remotely using what's called the flight termination system, and it's a remote control device that was sold to some U.S. carriers. It's a plug-in to Boeing's onboard computer. It's a plug-in device. I tell people it's almost as simple as a USB plug-in to your computer. Very simple. You don't have to rearrange your computer. But it was sold to some commercial airlines in the event, listen carefully to this, in the event that a hijacker were to get into the cockpit and take control of the aircraft, we, I don't know who we are, but I think I have an idea now, we can take control and remotely land that aircraft anywhere that we can get.
And there's nothing the hijacker could do.
That's correct. And there was nothing that the pilots could do on 9/11.
So you think... Well, now's the time to really get into methodical illusion. So you think, here are the pilots doing their thing, and all of a sudden, they can't control the plane.
That's correct.
Would they know instantly that somebody was guiding this plane?
They would never. It was sold in the event that a hijacker took control. They would never in a million years have dreamed that that device was actually controlling their aircraft. They would have just thought they were having some sort of mechanical. And the interesting thing about the flight termination system, and one of the reasons why a lot of the pilots and the Airline Pilots Association, their union, did not want this thing put on, is that once the flight termination system takes over via the transponder frequency, and so air traffic control loses track of you, you are no longer showing your transponder on their radar, and you lose all communication. You can't even communicate with the flight attendants in the cabin. And we are the eyes and the ears of the pilots because they have a cockpit door between us, them and the cabin. They don't know what's going on back there.
Interesting. All right, your book is a novel. It's not nonfiction. Why'd you write it in a novel form?
Well, for a couple good reasons. One, I'm hoping to prevent a drone strike on myself. And the information that I discovered was literally so mind-blowing for me. It made me physically sick when I really figured out what had happened and how it happened and who did it and how it was covered up. And so I wrote it mainly as a novel for, one, my safety, and two, I wanted to take all the information that I discovered in these thousands of hours of research I did into the entire event, not just the airplanes and where they went and what happened, but everything that happened that day, because I didn't know this until I went in. I was watching it all on TV for 10 days, and then I went back to work. And so I didn't know about the Brady Bonds and stolen gold and the put options and all of those things. I only knew about the crashes and the hijackers.
Right. And selling and stock short and everything else.
Exactly. And so when I discovered all that stuff, I thought, well, why don't I just go ahead and continue that novel I was going to start when I looked for that Middle Eastern name and write a book so that it would help wake people up to what has happened to us. Because 9/11 isn't our past, it's our future.
All right, well, let's talk about what we were told, first of all. Four planes taken over by 19 Middle Eastern terrorists who had been training and flying, at schools, flight schools. Are you saying that none of that occurred or that part of it occurred? What's your overall view there?
Well, what I discovered is, like I said, the first thing I discovered that six of those hijackers were a Saudi Arabian citizens, and the Saudi government was suing the FBI. Not only were they using their names, but they were using photographs from their passports and their ID.
Of people who were not on that plane, you're saying?
That's correct. Those people one of them had never been to the United States, and he didn't know what a Pennsylvania was. He was supposed to be on Flight 93 that crashed in Shanksville.
All right, where are those six now? I mean, why wouldn't... See, you know, if somebody had a picture of me as a terrorist taking a plane and they used it in Britain or the Middle East, and I'm here, believe me, you're going to know that I'm here.
Right. Well, the Saudi government stood up for its citizens and was threatening to sue, and I never could find a settlement, but I'm sure there must have been one, because and that was one of the things that really triggered my research, is that the FBI was being sued. These people were still alive, and four of them are pilots for Saudi Air. And being an airline professional for 30 years, I thought, whoa, can you imagine trying to travel as a pilot or flight attendant, and being accused of being a terrorist for the new Pearl Harbor?
Oh, it's not going to happen. But, I mean, why haven't these six, though, come forward to say, hello, here I am?
Well, they did. And as a matter of fact, you know, that's part of that BBC article, and their government sued. And what we were never told as Americans through our media and through the government handing out information to the media, that the lawsuit was either settled out of court or that these people really were alive. The FBI did eventually say that, well, there could be some mistaken identity and there may be a stolen IDs, but they never reneged on that. If you look in Wikipedia, those four or six citizens that are still alive, six of them, four of them are professional pilots, they are still considered to be one of the 19 hijackers from 9/11.
Okay.
They never changed their story.
All right, then the official version, 5, 5, 5, and 4 of those four planes, they took control of the plane. They, you know, slit throats with some people with their box cutters. Mm-hmm. They somehow got their way into the cockpits. They all somehow got to fly the planes. I still think the one in Pennsylvania was shot down by us. So what do you think happened on that plane? Give me your thoughts on that.
Okay. Well, one of the things I kept reverting back to is the FAA protocols and what the flight attendant should have said and done and what they did and what they didn't do, and just lining up with those protocols. One of the things that was a protocol, the FAA hijacking protocol at the time of 9/11, was called the Common Strategy. And basically that strategy was to delay, and prevent the hijacker from getting into the cockpit. And that meant delay any way we could. And there were many ways for us to try, and that was put out there for us in our yearly training. And one of the things you wouldn't want to do with a hijacker, a real hijacker on board, would be sit on the telephone for a half an hour. And on Flight 11, we had two flight attendants talking on the phone for 27 minutes. And the things that they said were what really woke me up.
All right, let's talk about that when we come back in a moment. Rebecca Roth with us, wrote a novel, but it's based on fact, Methodical Illusion. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM, and then continue, of course, to follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram. And let us invite you all to watch the television program here called Beyond Belief. You can sign up for it. It is 10 days free. And during those 10 days, by the way, you can watch all the programs if you want. Simply go to the website, beyondbelief.com. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you with Rebecca Roth, her book, Methodical Illusion. Rebecca, tell me about these phone calls.
Well, let me just try to remember where I was when we took that break. I was mentioning to you the common strategy of the FAA protocols. One of the things that the flight crew should have done was to sit down and to not draw attention to themselves. And what these first two did on the first flight, Flight 11, is they sat on the phone for about a half an hour, 27 minutes, both of them.
How do we know that, first of all?
Well, because it's well documented. One of them called her supervisor in Boston, and the other one called reservations. And so the reservations agent and the security officials from American Airlines documented that.
Okay.
Only 4 minutes of her call was taped to the reservations agent. Something went wrong with their system.
Oh, geez.
But the other gal, a lot of her stuff, and she was actually talking to a supervisor who was a personal friend, so that's how they know that was 27-minute phone calls. And they both called in at the same time. And like I said, if you had a real hijacker on board the aircraft, that would be the last thing you would want to be caught with, is a cell phone, any kind of air phone, anything to your ear, because he would think that you were ratting on him and telling the people on the ground who he was.
Sure.
And spoiling his plan. So making a phone call for almost a half an hour was a huge red flag. Not only did they not ever tell the most important bit of advice that day, if they had called someone on the ground, would have been how that person got into the cockpit. That's the only thing they should have been saying, and they never did say that. So these are the things that I looked at real closely. And so here we have on that very first flight, two flight attendants call in. At the same time, they call in about 20 minutes after takeoff from Boston.
Well, let me ask you this first of all, Rebecca. Is it unusual for flight attendants on a plane to be making phone calls?
Very.
Because, okay.
First off, the cell phones don't work at altitude. And
right.
Second off, those air phones are all gone now because they were horrible. You could only use one in first class and maybe one in coach at the same time. They were very, very bad quality. And they were expensive. So,
that's
the whole thing. The phone call thing is just really crazy. But, you know, according to the government story, they were mostly all calls from cell phones at altitude. So... Now, 20 minutes after Boston, they would have been pretty much at cruise altitude, probably close to 30,000 feet, depending upon the traffic pulling out of Boston. And this flight attendant, Betty Ong, they both call in at about the same time as well. And she says, this is the stuff that I could not believe. Now, I got most of this stuff from an FBI written document, transcript of what she said. And she said that he, as the hijacker was one hijacker, and he was a he had sprayed pepper spray or mace in business class, and we can't breathe in business class. Well, I've been on planes over this last 30 years where some real cheap perfume was sprayed in one cabin, and guess what? The entire aircraft smelled it and complained about it, right?
Right.
And so I knew that, and I knew that, she's sitting on the phone for 27 minutes, and she never complained to anyone she was talking to about suffering the effects of mace or pepper spray. She never coughed. She never complained about having a hard time breathing or anything like that. And let me just say this, because this is kind of earth-shattering. Most people don't think about this, and partly because they just don't have the experience I have with that cheap perfume. If you sprayed pepper spray or mace in a pressurized cabin, everyone would be feeling the effects of it. That would be the hijackers, the pilots, all the flight crew, and all the passengers. That indicated to me that that plane was no longer pressurized, because she said they only had trouble breathing in business class, and that's not real.
All right, so what does that mean if it was no longer pressurized?
That means it was on the ground somewhere.
Already?
Already. Mm-hmm. 20 minutes from Boston. And then she said something else that really got me, and this is when I told my husband, oh, my God, this is a message for a flight attendant, because only a flight attendant could hear this. She said he, as in that one hijacker male, he stood upstairs. And there are no stairs in a 767. There's only stairs in a 747. And I immediately knew she was in a hangar.
That's interesting.
Got the chills yet?
I'm getting there.
Okay, and then she goes on to say to a reservation agent, we're the first. And yes, indeed, Flight 11 was the first of the four aircraft. And then I realized that it was starting to look like she had been told what to say and what was going to happen that day by someone.
All right, go ahead.
She kept trying to convince the people that she was talking to reservations. She said, we're up in the air. And she said that a few times, we're up in the air. Well, saying you're up in the air in a hijacking is kind of like saying when you were carjacked, well, I was in my car. Because, of course, your hijacking only takes place in the air, because if somebody tried that on the ground, we'd blow those chutes and get you out of the airplane. And so I thought, well, why would she say they're in the air? It's a hijacking. That's kind of like being on a bike and saying you were carjacked. I mean, that just doesn't make sense. And then she went on to say that she was seated at her jump seat at 3R, which is the very tail section of the 767. That's 150-plus feet away from the business class cockpit area where all the mace and pepper spray was. But still, if you're pressurized, she's going to have that. The other flight attendant on the phone at the same time was giving completely conflicting information.
So the version that we have, of course... Mm-hmm. You know, the couple of those planes hit the World Trade Center. Are you saying that, well, obviously something hit the World Trade Center and we're pretty sure they were planes.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying they were not those planes?
That would be correct. And how I dissected this or deconstructed this was through all of the phone calls made on all four flights. And the similarities of what they were being told to say, and then I charted, here's my devil's tower in the living room. I charted what the NTSB, what the FAA said the aircraft were doing. Now, according to the official story on Flight 93, the aircraft's coming down at more than a 40-degree angle, and part of that time upside down, while those let's roll guys were bringing hot water into the cockpit. Impossible. In a 757.
Okay.
Impossible.
What planes, in your opinion, hit the towers?
You know, this is really interesting. Since my book has come out, I've got lots of American and United flight attendants, pursers, and pilots that are contacting me. And that the question most of the pilots say is, how did they get something? See, we didn't see what hit the North Tower.
No.
And so it just, whatever it is moving so fast we can't focus on it. And it looks smaller than a 767. A 767 is a big jet. And then what we saw hitting the South Tower looked like a 767, but it's actually a little bit out of sizing for the 200 series that it was supposed to be. And there's some kind of pod formations underneath it. There's some oddities that the pilots are telling me that they see, too. And they want to know how in the world, have I figured this out? And no, I haven't. But how in the world did they get that aluminum plane? Because we've seen hail strikes leaving, you know, Chicago and Detroit. And so if you can get baseball hail, that'll just rip a plane apart and you can have a serious problem. Or a bird strike. I mean, literally, go make a hole right in the aircraft. How could you get an aluminum plane to fly through a cement and steel building like that? And my answer is, I don't know. Airline professionals cannot grasp that, and that's the thing that I saw. I thought it was trick photography that morning. I could not. I just can't. I still to this day, I can watch that video over and over, and I can't understand how did they do that.
Okay, so
I don't really have an answer.
Let's make an assumption that your theories are correct.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to the planes that landed with the people who were in those planes?
Well, let me get to that in a little bit.
Okay.
Because that all works
that we're building up to that, aren't we?
Yeah, that all works into this story because let me kind of continue a little bit with the other flight attendant on that first flight that sat on the phone for such a long time. She did something else that raised a red flag for me as a flight attendant and a professional. She did something that was a mistake that no flight attendant would ever, ever make. And she called into her supervisor and claimed that the hijacker was seated at 9B. And then she called back and changed her mind later. But first off, you would never, ever call and say that a hijacker was someone unless you were 100% sure. And here's why. In that common strategy tactic, the FAA protocol, our job was to delay them getting into the cockpit, right?
That's right.
And then the whole plan was to land that aircraft. And if it was had the flight termination system, somebody could be doing that remotely for us. I didn't work for an airline that had that. So
now, let me ask you something. Would a pilot open up the cockpit door if they were told that hijackers were systematically killing people on the plane until they opened up that door?
No.
They would not?
No.
So even if they said, look, we just killed a flight attendant, we're killing another one in a minute, they would not open that door?
Nope. And here's the only thing that's really important to us as professionals, and this is pilots, flight attendants, pursers, all of us. When we put our uniform on, your safety as passengers and the safety of that aircraft are our number one concern. And so his number one concern would be to land that airplane
land
somewhere.
Land that plane
and get
somewhere.
A SWAT team. And, you know, if somebody died back there, it's not going to be all of them.
Right. And there's no way 20 minutes into that flight, the crew members would have opened up the door, gone to the bathroom. I don't see that happen. That happens later on. Later on, I've seen that happen on a plane, but not right away.
Yeah, exactly. And so as I started looking at it, I thought, well, first off, if I called in and said 9B was the hijacker, and then I didn't get a chance to change that story, and we landed, the SWAT team takes over, or the Army Rangers come in, and they'll take that guy down. And if I said it was you and it wasn't really you, I wouldn't want to make that mistake. So that's something that it's a mistake you just wouldn't make as a flight attendant. And so I for some reason, one day while I was doing all this research, I thought, well, gosh, I wonder who they said was this hijacker, 9B. And so I started to look, and unbelievable, the guy was a trained assassin. Can you imagine this? He was also an anti-hijacking specialist and a hostage rescue specialist. He was from a foreign intelligence agency. He was fluent in English. He grew up in Denver, Colorado. He was fluent in Hebrew and Arabic. He grew up in Denver until he was 14, moved to Israel, and then he learned Hebrew and Arabic while he was there. And so I'm like, well, that's really interesting. And then when the flight attendant calls back to her supervisor, she said, oh, no, I made a mistake. The hijacker was in 9B. And, I mean, 10B, and not 9B. 9B's been stabbed by the box cutter, right?
Mm-hmm.
So here you've got this guy who is a trained anti-hijacking specialist, a highly trained assassin, a hostage rescue specialist, who is fluent in the language being spoken by the hijackers who are planning the new Pearl Harbor, the attack of the century on America. And for no reason, there's no apparent reason, they decide to get up and stab him with a box cutter, and kill him, because we're led to believe that he died. He was stabbed by a box cutter.
And how did they systematically know it was him?
Well, they didn't. They don't. There's no answer to that one. And he was involved in the Israeli Special Intelligence Operations. It's referred to as Sayeret Matkal. These are the trained assassins, and they do the anti-hijacking and hostage rescue. So these would be the specialists that Israel would send to a hijacking, and like in Tunisia or someplace, you know, that go rescue their passengers. And they have actually been used. Benjamin Netanyahu's brother, and Benjamin Netanyahu was Sayeret Matkal, and his brother was actually killed in a hostage rescue attempt.
Yeah, he was.
Quite a while ago.
Right.
So here I found that really interesting that we have this guy who is listening to these people speak Arabic and plan to take over the aircraft, and for no reason they get up and kill him, yet this guy, 9B's friends, said about him he could kill any human being using a pen and a credit card.
And no, he wasn't going to go down easy, that's for sure.
But he did. Oh, well, we're expected to believe he did. But let's just move on from him because there is a lot, and there's a lot in the book about him because there's a lot written about
him.
Well,
we've got you for 3 hours, so we've got a lot to go.
We might go into some good details about him. And so It's really interesting to me that the flight attendants were saying, one was saying a doctor and a nurse were taking care of 9B after she said he was stabbed. And the other flight attendant, same flight, was saying there was no medical people on board. And so I'm saying, well, okay, you've only one. There's only one reality inside an aircraft cabin. It either is or it isn't.
It is or
right?
It isn't. That's right.
And so I like watching all this stuff and reading through, and I just took massive notes and drew all these charts of what the government said the aircraft was doing. Some of the aircraft were coming out of the sky. I know you've flown, and I know you know what this means, 6 to 10,000 feet per minute.
Yeah.
And you're expected to believe that someone's sitting on the phone showing no emotion, no fear, and that would be a very frightening thing. That is beyond if you were to do an emergency descent for decompression. You'd be pushing, coming down that fast. So it's pretty scary. I mean, the aircraft makes very scary noise. People are scared. People scream. And none of that's going on.
So let me ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying that the so-called hijackers, whether it was taken over electronically or not the point here,
mm-hmm.
are you saying they were not or they were on the planes?
The 19 hijackers that you are led to believe, I've actually found mm-hmm. 10 of them alive. The other nine intelligence officers are kind of suggesting that someone did exactly what I was going to do with my novel. They're fake people with a first name from somebody's ID and a last name from someone else's. So there were not Arab hijackers on any of the real passenger manifests. Another thing that's interesting about what the FBI claimed were the passenger manifests in that first 72 hours, they came up with four different names that are not, there were 19, but four of them were different than what they are right now and what they've been ever since, about 3 or 4 days into this event. And it's interesting because three of those people showed up alive. One of them was an FAA employee, and he said no. He was actually an FAA aviation safety employee in Florida. And so he, of course, went to the FAA and then went to the FBI and said, I'm not a hijacker. How could I be on the manifest? I was at work, and my brother, who you claim was also on the manifest, has been dead for a year. And the other two guys showed up alive, too. So quickly, while we were unfurling our flags and figuring out who were we going to point our guns at and kill over this attack, the FBI quickly changed their story. And the actual story about Mohammed Atta's rental car with the Koran and the flight manuals and his will was actually assigned to the brother, the FAA employee, and his dead brother.
Well, and I've got to tell you, too, Rebecca, of anything that I heard, finding a passport of one of these reported hijackers in the rubble was the most bizarre for me.
And they found two. One was in Shanksville, and one was in New York.
In pristine condition.
And the only passports they found were from those supposed hijackers.
Yeah.
Not any passengers. Now, consider this, that there were nearly 100 people on Flight 11. And only one hijacker's passport must have gone from his shirt through the building, through the explosion, and floated down. So you see, what happens now with us, and this is what's amazing to me, and I wrote this book, I thought maybe 12 people would read it, but it's been number one since the end of January.
Oh, I know it. It's huge. I mean, there were four crashes. You agree?
There were, but they were not these aircraft. These aircraft were all taken to the same location. And how I found that, one, I actually flew out of Boston for a while. But two, I knew that the phone calls had to have been made on the ground.
Well, I got to tell you, on one of the flights from Boston going to L.A. that hit the towers, my uncle from my mother's marriage, her sister married a guy who had a brother on that flight. So he wasn't a blood uncle of mine, but he was there. I want to tell you about him. He's still gone. So I want you to tell me where he is. We'll be back.